Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
It is Cyber Monday 2019. A lot of money is being spent online today, so we figured what better time than today to talk about cybersecurity, and we're going to do that in just a bit. I hope you stick around for that conversation. But to start our show today, first, we're going to revisit a story that we've talked about before. It's about driver's licenses and undocumented immigrants. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU. Thank you for being part of our show today. I'm Ron Ropiak, your well-fed and now on a diet host, and I hope you also had a great Thanksgiving. But now it's back to work at least for a few more weeks before we get to eat more over the next holiday, right? As I said a moment ago to start our discussion today, we're going to pick up on one that we had a few months back. It's about undocumented immigrants in New York State and a law that says if they have proper documentation, they can get driver's licenses. The reason we're talking about this now is, and we're going back over the story again, is that if the lawsuits trying to stop this don't go through, if they don't succeed, then within a few weeks from now, the law will go into effect. And that is going to have, we think, a big impact on our region and many of the businesses here. Yancey Roy is joining us to talk about this. Yancey is the Albany Bureau Chief for Newsday. Hey, Yancey, how are you? How was your holiday?
I'm good.
Everything go well over Thanksgiving?
Exactly. Good to have you. Good to be on, Ron.
Fantastic. Thank you for doing this. As always, we appreciate your time. Yancey, can we begin at the beginning? I mean, what does the new law do?
Well, the new law would allow people who are undocumented immigrants who are here to apply for driver's license. Folks should note that New York allowed this prior to the September 11th attacks. After that, it was stricken by then-Governor George Pataki. Elliot Spitzer sought to revive the program in 2007, but there was a strong political backlash, and so it went back dormant again. Fast forward to 2019, the state legislature is now fully in control of the Democrats, and this was one of dozens of liberal initiatives that they approved during their first year in control of both houses of the legislature.
So, Yancey, who opposes it now and why?
Well, in the legislature, most Republicans oppose it. And also, notably, there are a number of upstate county clerks who not only oppose it, but they've tried to file suit to block it. And there are some that have said if immigrants apply for these licenses, they are ready to turn over the names and other information to federal immigration services.
So the county clerks themselves are threatening to do this?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So they would be breaking the
law,
right?
In some counties, yes. Mm-hmm.
And that would be breaking the law?
Well, their contention is that granting a license in this case is breaking federal law, and the state is putting us in the position of breaking the law, and that's why they have filed suit, most notably Mickey Carnes from Erie County, which is Buffalo, filed a lawsuit seeking to strike down the entire law as unconstitutional before it ever took effect. However, about 3 weeks ago, his lawsuit was dismissed in court out in Western New York for a couple of reasons. One was the judge said it was premature. The law hasn't even gone into effect yet. And second of all, there was a question of legal standing, which is a legal term, but basically it means that Kearns himself had not shown how he personally would be impacted by this law taking effect.
I read some of your reporting on it, and if I was reading between the lines correctly, he was basically saying, sure, it impacts me because you're making me do something that I'd be breaking the law according to the federal regulations. How can it not impact me?
That's his contention. And also the second part of his contention is if I refuse to grant licenses, I could be subject to removal by Governor Andrew Cuomo. who would have the power to try at least to remove county clerks if they don't follow through in the law. And it's interesting to take note here. When New York passed its same-sex marriage license, Governor Cuomo very openly and publicly said that he would act to remove county clerks who would not grant marriage license. Fast forward to this issue, and the governor has not made that same kind of threat about enforcing the law. In fact, you know, in this issue on this law, the governor has been a little bit hands off. You know, he had warned the legislature that he thought there were problems, potential problems with the legislation, in that eventually the Trump administration and federal immigration officials could get the info from the driver's license applications and then seek to deport people. And he had warned them to think twice about doing this law, and he kind of reluctantly signed it, and ever since then has been kind of more or less adopted the stance that this is the legislature's baby, you know, it's in their hands, because the administration hasn't done a lot to, say, promote the law and say that it's taking effect, and they haven't reacted with the same ferocity against opponents of the law as it did if you go back to the same-sex marriage law.
Sure, because, you know, if I'm an undocumented immigrant and I'm listening to our discussion right now and I'm hearing you say, look, that there's some county clerks who are saying, you know, I may hand this information over to the federal government. If I'm an undocumented immigrant, I'm thinking twice about whether or not I'm going to actually try to get my driver's license.
Yeah, I think that's a real concern right now. I mean, we are less than 2 weeks away from the law taking effect, which is December 14th. And I think the big question is how many people are actually going to apply for the licenses? And, you know, you put yourself in that position, you might think twice about, they say our information's not going to be made available, but do I still want to go forward and apply for the license? I don't know. That might be going through the minds of some people who otherwise might apply. In fact, we should note that we noted the county clerk's lawsuit. In response, the New York Immigration Coalition and some other groups had filed a suit against the Rensselaer County clerk and other county clerks who had said that they wouldn't comply or said they would overturn information. And on a similar note, just a few days ago, last week rather, that lawsuit was dismissed in a federal court, in part because it was premature. So you've got county clerks on one side trying to sue before the law takes effect. It's dismissed as premature. Immigration advocates trying to sue some of the county clerks before the law takes effect, and that one's been dismissed as premature.
Who knew that being a county clerk would be such a precarious position, huh? I mean, wow. I wonder if some of them are thinking twice about what they're doing nowadays. I just want to mention Connecticut. It's been legal in Connecticut for a number of years for undocumented immigrants to actually go get a driver's license. Sergeant Charles Grasso is going to be joining us right after the break. He's going to tell us what the stats are since it has been in effect, and in terms of accidents and so on, and whether or not it's had any effect in Connecticut, and the sergeant will be coming up. But Yancey, I've got like 2 minutes left with you, so I just want to grab one or two other questions before we bring in the sergeant. Why are some business owners in favor of this? Because I remember when we spoke about this months ago, and some business owners had written to us, sent us emails saying, look, this will help us, especially on Long Island. So what have they told you? Why are they in favor of it?
I think general, the folks, the arguments about being in favor of it is it would, in fact, increase safety. People would be able to obtain a license, be covered by insurance, not have to worry about how to get back and forth to work or miss work because you don't have reliable transportation. It would reduce the number of uninsured drivers on the road. And I think all in all, the general idea is the more, from the advocate's argument, the more people that you have in the system, so to speak, and covered by insurance and other laws, driving laws, et cetera, the better it is for the whole pool of not only consumers, but people who have to buy insurance.
And I think also from one of your articles, they said, look, you know, that this will, the revenue, they'll be paying for this. They'll be paying for licenses, insurance. It'll be good for the bottom line for the state. Finally, my last question for you is, as you said, I think December 14th is when it is scheduled to go into effect. Does that
Correct.
Hinge on any legal arguments at the moment?
No. As of right now, it's set to go into effect on December 14th. We should note that some of the Republicans in the state legislature, have proposed bills that would shield any DMV or county clerks from punishment if they don't want to comply with this law. That's the kind of bill that's going nowhere in Albany, but I think it's more of an attempt by the Republicans to raise issues about this law and draw some criticism about it.
So they're going to try and propose this in the next legislative session?
Yes.
Okay. All right. It's just, today is just the beginning of December, right? So it'll be happening pretty soon. December 14th is the day. And do me a favor. Could we contact you in the next week or two and we'll check in and see how it's going?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thanks, Yancey. I always appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. I'll speak with you soon. Yancey Roy, he runs the Albany Bureau for Newsday. It's always great having him on the air with us. Joining us is retired Sergeant Charles C. Grasso III. The sergeant is a crash data liaison accident reconstructionist. He's at the UConn Transportation Safety Research Center. Now, we're bringing the sergeant in to talk about this because while New York is just weeks away from doing this, Connecticut has been doing it for a while. Sergeant, thanks for being with us. I appreciate your time. Thanks for holding on.
No problem. Thank you.
How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Connecticut's been doing this since what? I think I read earlier, 2013?
2015.
2015. My apologies. 2015. What are you seeing from your stats? And any effect on accidents and were people walking away from accidents? How has it affected Connecticut?
It was pretty interesting statistics. We have 2016, 17, and 18 data shows a 9% overall decrease in hit and run accidents, with the major cities being down about 15% each.
I just want to make sure that I heard you. You're saying that the numbers actually went down?
Our hit-and-run crashes went down, yes.
Is this attributed directly to this law?
Well, in speaking with police officers all over the state, they said they're seeing a lot of what they call drive-only licenses in Connecticut being presented in these crashes. So one could assume that these would have been fleeing the crash in previously, because now they're trained, they have insurance, they have documentation to say who they are. They're not leaving the scenes of the crashes.
Can you explain for those who don't know what a drive-only license is? I know it's self-explanatory, but just in case, could you just spell it out a little bit?
Sure. The state of Connecticut, when they did this, created a drive-only license, which means you can't go to the airport and use it as ID to get on an airplane. The TSA won't accept it. It's not meant for definitive identification. It's meant to prove that you're a capable driver, basically. You've met all the standards to drive within the state of Connecticut.
You know that they're debating this in New York State for a number of reasons. There are a number of county clerks who are upset by this, and they cite federal regulations and so on. But from the numbers that you're seeing, the statistics, and I'm not asking you to get into the whole political, you know, which side or whatever. Is there anything from a statistical number point of view that would tell you this is not a good program?
No. As a matter of fact, our hit-and-run numbers were consistent for years prior to this happening, and this is the only 3 years we've seen a decrease.
Do you have any other thoughts on this? Any other statistics that you would like to cite before we let you go? Because I appreciate you coming on and talking about this.
Originally we had, and the last time I checked, 50,000 people applied for these licenses, which means income for the state, income for businesses. It also allows police officers in some of the major cities, if they didn't have ID, people at a crash scene didn't have ID, it would take almost hours to determine who they were. Now the officers are finding that they're clearing up a lot quicker, and it's a lot easier on everybody all around to get the with these licenses. So it's been a positive effect in Connecticut.
So would it be fair to say that with the knowledge that you have, the numbers, the statistics, that you are a fan of this?
Well, I'm definitely a fan. Anything that I can do to save lives on the highway, and if this is getting people better trained and it's getting the identification out there and keeping people at the scenes of crashes, I'm in favor of it.
Retired Sergeant Charles C. Grasso III, a crash data liaison, accident reconstructionist at the Yukon Transportation Safety Research Center. Sergeant, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Have a good day, sir.
Be well. You too. All right, we're going to move on to the second part of our program. We just really wanted to talk to the sergeant to find out the Connecticut angle of the story. And as I said to you, as we get closer to the December 14th date, we'll see where this stands. We're going to move on to the second part of our show because, as we all know, today is Cyber Monday. And according to many of the news reports over the last day or so, more and more of us did our holiday shopping online the last few days than maybe ever before. If you were one of those, while you were filling out your payment information, did you give any thought as to whether or not what you were doing was safe? I mean, do you know who was looking at your information? Were you buying from a secure computer at home? Were you on a public Wi-Fi? I don't know if you heard the newscast. Ebong Udama was talking with a professor from Quinnipiac, and he was talking about cybersecurity, and he had a great line, and he was saying, in terms of cybersecurity, only the paranoid survive, which pretty much says it all when it comes to this. Now, with all of this in mind, with many of us doing more and more of our shopping online the next few weeks, let's chat for the remainder of the program about cybersecurity. And we're going to start off with Professor Hak Kim. The professor is Associate Professor of Information Systems and Business Analytics, the chair and co-director of the new Cybersecurity Innovation and Research Center at Hofstra University. Professor Kim, welcome, sir. Thank you for coming on today.
Hello. Hi, Ron. My name is Hak Kim.
It's wonderful to have you on, and we are going to clear up that phone line. And are you there, Professor?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, give us 1 second. There you go. Now we're all clear.
Right.
Okay, Professor, I got to ask you. With your background, were you busy helping friends and family over the holiday, making sure no one got ripped off?
Thanks for asking. My Thanksgiving was pretty great, and I enjoyed the holidays instead of the classes. So I invited my friends. They are from Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and D.C., and Albany.
Okay.
Fun.
It sounds like it. tell us about your new research center at Hofstra. Why was this needed? Why did you need to open this?
Sure. Yeah. I'm very thrilled Hofstra University Cybersecurity Innovation and Research Center launched. And also we held opening ceremony on November 12, 2019. Actually, the center is funded with Empire State Development Grant awarded through Long Island Regional Economics Development Council and also matching grant from Hofstra University over total $1.35 million. Yes, then our center is more than 1,000 square foot facility equipped cutting-edge cybersecurity technologies and also AI-powered simulation training platform to create a real hype like a cybersecurity environment. So that's our center is very proud of these kind of facilities and tool sets.
Now, one of the reasons that we're having our conversation today is it's Cyber Monday, plus also the fact that you've opened up your new center. And so many of our listeners are indeed thinking about shopping today, and that's important. But when it comes to cybersecurity, we need to mention this. We're talking about identity theft. We're talking about hospitals and businesses being held ransom, towns without records. And this is happening more and more, isn't it?
Yes, correct. Yeah, so we usually recommend please do not use some Wi-Fi in the public places. And also to not give the some your credit cards to the physical stores. Similarly, in the cyber, it's a very kind of the same environment. We think about always exposed by the our the hackers. So very they are very smarter and smarter. They are avoid some our cybersecurity protection technologies. So hackers kind of on top of that and steal the data or really hard to protect.
Professor Kim, are these hackers here in the United States or are they in other countries?
Yeah, definitely all over the world. Yeah, that's the not limited in the physical space in the not only U.S. nation. Especially we heard a lot of the news from the other countries, especially including, I do not distinguish specific country names, but many countries, global hackers, try to attack our U.S. nations, especially also New York area and including Long Island is like a capital city of the finance. There's a really dangerous situation in New York metropolitan area.
Professor, if I have a business, if I have a small business, medium business, big business, whatever, if I run a city or a town or a hospital, do I need insurance for this?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I need like you need kind of protect by from the your some cybersecurity companies. Definitely needed protect yourself because think about your damage of your valuable assets. Even though you're a small business, they can hack any place, any person. So definitely I strongly recommend to contact the security companies or vendors to secure your systems.
Well, funny how this leads into the next portion of our conversation. Greg Knepper is with us. Greg is the president of the Integrated Coverage Group. Greg, thanks for joining us. We appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
You sell insurance, right?
I do.
Yes, specifically, you sell cyber insurance?
We have a full-service insurance brokerage, but we do specialize in cyber insurance, and we've been working with the Long Island market and kind of the tri-state area for about 7 or 8 years now in the cyber insurance space.
Okay, so what is cyber insurance? How is that different from the other insurance that I buy?
Sure. Well, one of the biggest misconceptions about cyber insurance is that it is included or part of insurance policies that business owners already have. And sometimes you will have a case where a business owner's policy might include cyber insurance, but oftentimes it is a watered-down version of what the business should have, and oftentimes there's not enough coverage. And so typically it is a standalone insurance policy that helps a business in the event that they do have some sort of cyber attack or data breach. And that can come in many different fashions. Stolen information, if somebody, a bad actor tries to extort money from the company by holding their data hostage, there's a whole host of different types of coverage that is part of a cyber policy that is not part of a standard liability or property policy that most businesses should have.
You know, Greg, I have to say, the first time I heard of this, I thought, why would I need this? Shouldn't this be covered under my umbrella policy?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, it's definitely a misconception that it's included in coverage that, you know, folks already have, particularly for established businesses that have had certain coverage in place for 5, 10, 20, 50 years. They never had cyber liability coverage, and so they kind of say, oh, I don't have that, I don't need it, but in fact, they do need it. We tell all of our clients, whether it's a sole proprietor working out of their home with one computer, all the way up to our national clients with hundreds or thousands of employees, that cyber insurance is something that's really important to have. It can be very inexpensive. We have small clients that are paying under $1,000 a year for cyber insurance, and it's protecting their business because if you have a cyber attack, a high percentage of companies that suffer a significant cyber attack never come back. They go out of business within a year. And for a relatively minimal cost, you can protect your business with cyber insurance.
Professor Kim, I read a number earlier today, and I don't know if this number was accurate because it kind of blew it kind of blew my mind a little bit. It said that not next year, but the year after, cybercrime will cause $6 trillion worth of damages worldwide in 2021. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I cannot justify that number, but I can imagine. Because several years ago, there was a projection, not only the damage, but damage was around 300, every kind of average data breach cost of the companies around $4 million. And multiply some, I don't know how many companies, then maybe kind of $1 billion, $6 billion, just so you can imagine.
Well,
and also, I know I have some data based on the IBM. In 2018, around 4 billion records were compromised to data breaches.
Imagine that was that was in that was in 2018, 4 billion records.
Yes, right. So now you think about the 2021, more increasing, growing and kind of cyber crimes. So I can easily kind of agree about the more than $6 billion.
Oh no, this wasn't billion. The number that I saw was $6 trillion.
$6 trillion.
Wow. Dollars. But that was worldwide. They said from the amount of cities and companies and hospitals, and they said it's just going to explode.
Any financial companies? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't have a specific data about that issues, but just we can feel it's a really a huge amount of, a humongous amount of the damage will occur in the future. That's why we need a cybersecurity workforce professionals to prevent or protect those damages.
Greg Knepper, a question for you in terms of the insurance. What about lawsuits? If I own a company and let's say someone gives me all this personal information and I get hacked, does insurance protect me from a potential lawsuit for something like that?
Absolutely. So the example we typically use is in the medical arena, which is often is a highly targeted sector because of that information. So we insure a lot of medical practices. So if you have a medical practice, let's just say over time they've accumulated 5,000 patients, whether they're active or not, and somehow somebody gets into their system. Now they have HIPAA-protected information for 5,000-plus patients, plus credit card information, dates of birth, Social Security number. All of that data has a lot of value on the black market. If that medical practice is hacked and that information is stolen, by law, they have a duty to report that, and they need to notify all of those individuals that were affected. By law, they need to do that. After that, they need to provide credit monitoring for those folks. So just a notification, think about sending out a letter to 5,000 people. There's significant cost there. Then there's credit monitoring. There's significant cost there. There's all different numbers in the industry, but and I've seen the numbers anywhere from, call it $150 to $250 per record in terms of the cost of a data breach, to provide credit monitoring and whatnot. Those are all things that are potentially covered in a cyber insurance policy. And then, of course, they potentially pay for a PR firm to sort of spin it in order to, if you just have the doctors kind of writing a letter to all these patients, it's probably not going to look that great.
Sure.
PR firm that gets the word out and does the right thing. And like many things in business, it's not necessarily what happened. It's how the business responds to it and how they, treat their patients and customers going forward. So
Greg,
all those things are really important.
I have to jump in because I have to take a break. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. Please come back with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg. Greg Knepper, president of the Integrated Coverage Group, and Professor Hak Kim, associate professor of information systems and business analytics, chair and co-director of the new Cybersecurity Innovation and Research Center at Hofstra. Professor Kim, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We're talking about cybersecurity on Cyber Monday. A lot of money being spent today. How do you know that everything that you're doing is safe? Your information is safe. If you listen to this program, you'll understand why one of the guests said before, and it was on the newscast, he said, only the paranoid survive, which may be the new motto of the full story. Professor Fred Scholl is with us. He's associate teaching professor of cybersecurity and director of the cybersecurity program at Quinnipiac University. Professor, welcome. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And I love your line, only the paranoid survive. I mean, I think that says it all. And, Professor, we have another guest joining us for a few minutes. Steve Morgan is with us. Steve is the founder and editor-in-chief of Cybercrime Magazine. Stephen, how are you?
Very good. Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Professor Scholl, I'd like to start with you. From all the reports that I'm seeing, businesses are desperately looking for more and more cybersecurity experts. How popular are your classes?
Well, ours started a year ago. We're fully online, and we directed our classes at working professionals who already may have some information technology skills or application skills and want to add in security skills. And the demand that we're seeing is to fill somewhere between 300 and 600,000 open positions right now in the U.S. for information security. So we looked at, you know, the pipeline of people coming up through traditional computer science and software engineering, and there's just not enough people there. So we focused our program on helping students make that sort of a career change from IT into IT plus security.
So are you talking, are you aiming your programs at those maybe in their mid-20s or 30s and so on and seeing if they want to switch things around a bit?
Well, interesting. So we do have some Quinnipiac undergraduates in the program. We just opened it up to them in the fall. So these are hardcore computer science and software engineering folks. They're, you know, seniors, so they're 21. But what I'm seeing is that people may have one career maybe for 10 or 20 years, so they're 30, 40, something like that. And then they want to get into a new hot area. And so it's those people that are able to, we're helping them make a transition into a hotter area than they may be in right now. And I think, as you just said in the beginning, security is a huge issue. Technology is pervading everything that we're doing. So it's going to be around for a long time.
Steve Morgan, I read your article that you have on your website, and I want to bring up the number that you quote. And I think it was in 2021, not next year, but the year after, it's predicted cybercrime damages will cost the world $6 trillion on an annual basis. Is that an accurate number?
It is, and it's up from about $3 trillion in 2015 to give you an idea of how fast it's growing.
That's incredible. I mean, do people realize how much money we're talking about?
Do people realize? They're starting to realize. Governments realize. Big businesses realize. I don't think consumers realize until something happens to them.
Now, there's something else that you were writing about, and it was that all of the information that we're talking about, and today we're talking, you know, it's Cyber Monday, and so we're concerned about security and buying things and whether or not our credit cards are going to be hacked. And it's been written that all the information, our information, has already been stolen and is already now out there on the dark web. Is that accurate?
It is accurate. There's varying degrees of information that's out on the dark web and available for sale. It's been there for the past decade, and the amount of information continues to grow with the, you know, more recent hacks and data breaches that we're seeing.
So, Professor Scholl, my question is, if everything's already out there, then, you know, what can we do?
Well, I agree that, you know, everything is already out there, but it's in different places, right? There were different hacks out there. It is on the dark web, but it has to be put together in a way that would enable an attack against an individual or a small business. And this is what's happening. That's why, you know, I think this is kind of the golden age of fraud that we're going into. So what can we do? So it depends on whether you're an individual or a small business. So individuals need to make sure that they have a secure home computing system. They need to use best practices not to go shopping on Cyber Monday or any other day when they're in an airport and things like that. They also need to, I think what people need to do is spend, if they spend, you know, 20 hours a week looking for bargains online and things like that, and we know that this Cyber Monday is going to be a record Cyber Monday, and probably next year's will be another record. So we know this is happening, but I think people need to spend some amount of time educating themselves on what kinds of frauds and scams are out there. And Mr. Morgan's magazine sounds like a good resource. Others that I've run across are the Connecticut Better Business Bureau has a good web page highlighting recent frauds. And then the group, the AARP, also has a fraud watch. You can subscribe to that. So if a new fraud comes along, you'll get it as a text message or an email. So you need to educate yourself, basically, and then follow a lot of the best cyber hygiene practices. But it's knowing what kind of fraud is out there in the first place that you have to defend yourself against.
Steve Morgan is still with us. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of Cybercrime Magazine. Again, Steve, I enjoyed reading your article today, and anyone can find it at your website. But one or two things that I took away from it is that you wrote that every single business is going to be hacked at some point. No one will be immune. Is that correct?
It's true, and it's true of consumers, too. In fact, you've probably been hacked, and just don't know it.
When you say hacked, does that mean someone has come into my computer, into my phone, my laptop, whatever?
Your phone, your laptop, your bank account, the number of transactions that are occurring are just too vast for most consumers to keep up with. There's a lot of fraud that is 99 cents and $1.99, minuscule transactions. There are also, the beginnings of a hack and you don't even realize it. So, you're going out shopping today. A lot of people are going out shopping and they're going to be volunteering their email addresses when they really shouldn't be. So to your question earlier, what can people be doing or what should they know? I think it starts with just, basic protection. Don't give your email address. You don't have to, even though a cashier makes you feel like you do, because I guarantee you, read the papers in a week from now and in 2 weeks from now, there will be a data breach that occurs on Cyber Monday and in the aftermath of Cyber Monday and this, intense holiday season that we're in the middle of.
Well, I'm sorry. No, you were saying about emails. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've gone to stores where, you're filling out some application and some clerk turns to me and says, "And can I have your social security number?" And I'm like, "What?" but there are some who gladly hand it over.
It's sure. Cyber criminals prey on a lack of knowledge. They target the elderly. They target, all kinds of demographics, including shoppers who psychologically are conditioned to, give up this information.
Professor Scholl, how bad of a problem is it in the Connecticut and Long Island region? And the reason I ask that is because there are articles that are being written saying, look, so many more attacks are taking place at hospitals and town halls, insurance companies and so on. They're just not being reported because the people who are being hacked are trying to keep it quiet.
Yeah, I agree. So I haven't seen that Connecticut is worse or better than national averages. I see that it's pretty similar. So we've had ransomware attacks on schools and municipal governments. We've had attacks on hospitals and other attacks on small businesses. We've had the other kinds of personal scams like romance scams. We've had those. So I think we've had our share of typical kinds of scams that are out there. And so I think just in terms of just back to what should people do, I think, yes, everybody will be hacked, whether you're an individual, small business, or enterprise corporation. So on the individual side, you need to go back to the old-fashioned, review your bank statements on a regular basis, review your credit card statements. So my credit card was stolen a few months ago, and I wasn't that diligent. It took me a couple months to see that something, I had it. Charge of a couple hundred bucks every month from the same fraudulent vendor, but I finally did catch it and get it reversed. So you have to be able, yes, you will be hacked, you have to have your response plan in place for how you're going to defend against it and minimize the impact.
So, you know, our news director is in the other room right now, and he said the same thing I was just thinking. You're a cybersecurity expert, right? And you still had your credit card hacked. I mean, if that happens to you, what about for, you know, me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did I just lose you, Professor Scholl? All right, I think we lost Professor Scholl for one moment. We'll try and get him back. Obviously, the phone cut off there. Stephen Morgan, are you still with us, sir?
I am.
Okay, great. What I was thinking about was what you were saying a little bit earlier, that it's the small crimes, like you said. Someone all of a sudden, it's 99 cents. It's 99 cents. It's $1.29, and you're not even noticing these things, right? All right, we lost Stephen Morgan, so don't worry. We're having a little phone issue or two today. We will try to get them back, and we're going to bring back Stephen Morgan at one point, and we're going to bring back Professor Fred Scholl. We'll get them all back. Everton Henriquez is with us right now, or at least he's going to be with us in a few minutes, who is the New York Manufacturing Extension Partnership Solutions Director at Fuse Hub, and they are having a conference this Thursday, where they are inviting manufacturers to show up to learn the latest rules and regulations from the DOD, the Department of Defense, which has to do with cybersecurity. So there's a lot to be taking place right now in our area. We've had some phone issues. I ask you to stay with us. We'll get our guests on the line in just a minute. But in the meantime, if you want to join in the conversation, drop us an email. What the heck? We're at TFS at WSHU.org. On Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU. And remember that all the shows, any show that you want to listen to, the Full Story, is available as a podcast. Download the Full Story on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or on Google Play. Now, we are going to get back to our guest. Henriquez is on the line. Everton Henriquez is the New York Manufacturing Extension Partnership Solutions Director at Fuse Hub, and that's F-U-Z-E Hub. Everton, thank you for being with us. We appreciate your time and your patience today. How are you, sir? And he was just with us, and now he's not. It's Everton. Oh, I hear something in the background. How are you, sir?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Thank you for coming on. I apologize about the phone issues, and I'm glad we were able to connect. Tell us about the conference you have coming up later in the week.
Okay, so this conference is aimed at small to medium-sized manufacturers, especially those involved in the DOD supply chain. It will be held on the 5th of December at Stony Brook University at the Seawitt Center. It's free, open to the public, and the added advantages that we're offering are a couple of cybersecurity grants of